It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Russian operatives compromised the voting websites or databases of at least seven states in 2016. We are 8 weeks away from our midterm elections. So how safe, how vulnerable is the election system this time around? David Hickton is the founder and director of the University of Pittsburgh Institute of Cyber Law, Policy, and Security. Prior to that, David Hickton was the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania for more than 6 years, during which time he brought the first such indictments against Chinese military members for economic espionage against Pittsburgh-based companies, and he created a section in the office to focus on cybercrime and national security. David Hickton, welcome to the Confluence.
Good to see you again.
David, last September, it was reported that the Department of Homeland Security notified 21 states, including Pennsylvania, that they were targeted by hackers during the 2016 election. Specifically targeted, how so, and is there any sense to the success of that targeting?
Well, that meant that the Russians were trolling in our election systems, and here's a visual to understand that. Think about a neighborhood where there are burglars on the loose. There were 21 residences where the burglars were circling the neighborhood. There were seven where they were in the house, and one, Illinois, has acknowledged that they were actually taking things away. That's the best way to understand what Homeland Security has told us.
So they were scoping things out. They made penetration. And so only one is acknowledged. Does that mean the other six, they didn't get anything, or they just haven't acknowledged?
Well, the states are struggling because I don't believe we are served by defining this threat narrowly. I think that we can assume, because election hacking goes back to 2012 and 2008 as well, we can assume that our adversaries are looking at our voting rolls. We can assume that they're testing the methods to try and attack our vulnerable election machines. And we know that not only the machinery and the rolls are at risk, but the information that we rely upon to make our decisions have been interfered with as well. I don't like the term meddling. I think that's what mothers-in-law and fathers-in-law do. This is interference in one of the most critical infrastructures in our country because we're the world's leading example of democracy. So I like to define the threat expansively. Now, some say that that's not a good idea. And the reason they say that is that we're doing the work of our adversaries for them, because by just defining the threat expansively, we are creating uncertainty about our elections. But I personally believe we're well beyond that. We need to give people confidence by acknowledging the risk.
So acknowledge publicly, but also add to it what you're doing to offset it, to prevent it, or what?
Well, I think this is like any other cyber threat. We need to acknowledge the threat and also recognize that we can protect ourselves. And it's at first a risk reduction process because, like crime, we can't protect ourselves against all cyber threats, but we can do many things to reduce the risk down too negligible. And I think in the election area, we can do some things that we're not doing, such as training our people in the states who do this work, such as replacing obsolete machines, such as taking steps to do risk-limiting audits, such as developing for the future some cyber technology or digital technology that can be secure from penetration.
David, the name of the institute that you founded at the University of Pittsburgh, the Institute of Cyber Law, Policy, and Security. How do the first two, law and policy, lead to the third, security?
Well, I think it's based upon a recognition that the law moves very slow, and in this space, technology moves very fast. So there's a gap that's growing every day between the platform of our laws, which make us secure, and the changing technology, which is wonderful. I mean, the technology here has allowed us to communicate much better than we ever did when I was growing up. And it offers us great promise to do such things as harvest the technology for purposes of maybe we could have evacuated Puerto Rico better during the flood. Maybe we can do a better job solving disease if we can protect the commons of medical records. This is what the medical community tells me. So security and access are always integrated. And if we are going to protect people on this platform, we have to make sure the law and policy catches up to the technology.
Okay. So law, do you mean the enforcement of law, the creation of new laws, enactment of legislation? What do you mean by slow? And were you sort of, shall we say, handcuffed by that when you were U.S. attorney?
I was. And we have challenges across the spectrum because many of the laws that we used for purposes of bringing our legendary cyber enforcement actions here, we had to jackhammer our evidence into a dated portfolio of laws. So we could stand as a country to improve the encyclopedia of laws we have to enforce against cyber threats. But at root, all laws are based upon codifying standards of conduct, which are sort of norms of behavior. And what we have to do is recognize that we outlawed things in the pre-digital age that we're not outlawing in the digital age. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
Suppose I were to reach across this table and take your paper by accident, all your notes about this interview. You would expect me in the pre-digital age to give that back to you. You certainly had the right to expect I wouldn't take it across the street and sell it to your competitor. And yet, in the digital age, we routinely seem to accept that if someone finds someone else's personal property online, they can read it, or they can sell it, or they can use it to influence an election. I reject that. But the codification of these norms really has to be the subject of a reset button, not only within this country and across the world.
All right. So when you were U.S. attorney, I mean, you were the top law enforcement officer for this entire region of Western Pennsylvania, a lot of authority, specifically when it comes to cybersecurity, referencing some of the famous cases, famous indictments that your office did. But is there something that you can do now in your current role as, you know, founder and director of this institute that you couldn't do as U.S. attorney?
There are many things. This wonderful opportunity that has been given to me by Chancellor Gallagher at University of Pittsburgh offers me a unique and challenging opportunity to do a lot of things I couldn't do as U.S. attorney. Look, as U.S. attorney, I had, as you point out, decision-making authority and the power to indict. And I expanded those boundaries by being very active in outreach and trying to be a leader on the big challenges of the day, whether they were cyber, opioids, community police trust, fraud in education. And I'm proud of that work. But here, I'm unencumbered by my responsibilities as U.S. attorney, and I can imagine horizons even further. And I can present, as we're trying to do, for example, in our election commission, I can present to the decision makers in Pennsylvania options and opportunities that perhaps I as a decision maker and they themselves could not identify as freely as I can as an academic.
But it's up to them then to make policy and take action based on recommendations, information that you have discovered and laid out for them.
And absolutely. So my authority now is the merit of my good ideas, whereas my authority before was my pen.
So when it comes to election security, do you think that there are some states, there are elections officials that are in denial about the vulnerability?
There are for two reasons. One is a good reason, one is a bad reason. The good reason is, as I said before, we don't want to do the work of our adversaries for them by rattling the public and making the public feel that our elections are unsafe or unreliable. So we don't want to be exaggerating the threat. But the reason that I think that many of them are denying this, which I think is a bad reason, is that it is a normal human reaction, especially if you're a responsible person on duty, to deny you've been hacked. Nobody likes to admit it. And just in the time I was U.S. attorney, we watched how companies routinely would fire their chief security information officer. And then with the Target case, the CEO got fired. And then with the Equifax case, the spotlight was squarely upon the board. So responsibility is really shared by all, but ultimately the most responsible party, who is the person who should be taking the steps to prevent. And in Pennsylvania And across the 50 states, because we run elections as a state enterprise, it is really the governor and it's the state election officials who are on the watch.
Just a couple of minutes left. So what's being done? Is it costly? Do we have to return almost to low-tech sort of paper trails, receipts for ballots, paper absentee ballots?
In the short term, there is really no digital solution that we can fully secure. So the best option really is paper ballots with a self-limiting audit. And we need to remove the so-called DRE machines, which are widely used in Pennsylvania, which are very hackable. Over the long term, I think we can protect ourselves, but it's always going to be challenging because, particularly in the public sector, the purchase horizon is a long horizon because you're dealing with public money. And the technology, as I said, is changing fast. Look, for your listeners, just imagine how many phones you've had in the last 10 years and how we laugh at flip phones like they are low-tech technology. And at one time, we couldn't even imagine that we would use a flip phone. We thought that was something that came from Star Trek.
All right. In our remaining minute, so how would you rate the chances of another attack on our election system? I mean, we're talking about, 8 weeks from now, our midterms.
I think the chances that we are going to be attacked, defined generally, are very high. But I think that we're doing some things that can reduce that down. There's great work being done here in Pennsylvania, and I hope we can help put a spotlight on it.
All right. Now, can we stay ahead of the hackers, the attackers, or are we always playing catch up?
I think we can, but we have to be vigilant, we have to be determined, and we have to not be in denial.
The security of our elections, not a partisan issue. Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina chairs the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He said Russian activities during the 2016 election may have been aimed at one party's candidate, but in 2018 and 2020, it could be aimed at anyone at home or abroad. Quick reaction.
Absolutely. This is a nonpartisan concern. It goes to the heart of our democracy.
David Hickton is the founder and director of the University of Pittsburgh Institute of Cyber Law, Policy, and Security. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow at this time, we'll be speaking with David Hickton's successor in the U.S. Attorney's Office about what directives he's received from Washington, from Attorney General Sessions, and his approach to dealing with undocumented immigrants. That's on Tuesday's Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Heinz Hall for the Performing Arts officially reopens after major renovations in 1971. Originally built as a movie palace called the Lowe's Penn Theater in 1927, Heinz Hall is owned by the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra and seats about 2,600 patrons. Due to decline in moviegoers and competition from elsewhere in the city, the theater fell into disrepair in the 1960s before being bought by symphony officials and redeveloped with help from city agencies. Now it's one of the city's busiest performance halls with about 200 shows and concerts each year. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 10th, 2018.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
This is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. 3 years ago, volunteers in Larimer converted an empty lot in their neighborhood into what's now known as the African Healing Garden. That group of volunteers was led by longtime community organizer Betty Lane. 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort recently joined Lane at the garden on Meadow Street to talk about her inspiration for the project.
Betty Lane, why did you want to create this garden?
Well, I feel like there needs to be a lot of healing, not just in this community, but all around the city. But, having lived through the gangs in this neighborhood and all of the violence and the killing, I felt like there needed to be a place of solace, a place where people could just come and sit and smell the aromas and participate in the fruit that's available, to just sit and relax, or to come and just have classes so the children can come and enjoy the plants and learn about the plants. And for me, it's just a place of solace. And to use the name African Healing Garden, is because I feel like it takes it back to the motherland.
So who else would you like to see use the African Healing Garden?
Well, that's why we have people that are involved on our committee that don't live in the neighborhood. And we really would like to have people come. We don't want just it to be wide open because it can be misused. We want to have certain hours that it's open, and we want to set it up for people who may want to bring their groups in, want to bring, you know, from other areas of the city, want to come and just tour, want to take a look.
But so what's in this garden?
We have two fig trees over to the right. We have two fig trees over there. We have a hazelnut tree. We have an elderberry bush. What else do we have over there?
Did I see an almond tree?
The almond is down there. The almond tree is down in the corner. We have a peach tree at the beginning when you come in. There's mm-hmm. a peach tree. There's chives down there, too, at the beginning.
What's your favorite part of this garden?
Well, you know, I'd like to sit on that rock that's up right above the pond. I like to sit over there on that rock because it's natural. You know, I just like there, and I like to sit by the water, except that, you know, once we get it flowing and stuff, I like to sit by the water. I like to hear the water. I like to hear the sound of the water running. And one of the things I like about it so much is that it's everybody planning. It's everybody putting in something in terms of if they're not able to do weeds and stuff like that, they're putting their ideas here. I have to say this, the community respects the garden, because no, they have not come in here and try to trash it because it's not locked, you know what I mean? So I feel like they do respect it, that they don't come in and try to destroy things. And that's, I'm very grateful about that too.
Betty Lane of the African Healing Garden in Larimer, thank you for taking time to do this interview.
And thank you for asking me, I appreciate that.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In Pittsburgh, nearly 3,000 babies were born so far this summer. And that means a lot of new parents are spending sleepless nights feeding, rocking, and bouncing their little bundles of joy, desperate for some shut-eye. 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed reports that experts agree that helping babies learn solid sleep skills is important for growth and development, but they have different ideas about how to get there.
Full disclosure, I had twins in February, and not so long ago, I was that desperate parent, endlessly trudging up and down the stairs to pop pacifiers into my little angels' mouths. That forced cardio led me to another set of stairs at the Carnegie Library's main branch in Oakland to do a little research.
Yeah, here we go. The Happiest Baby's Guide to Great Sleep. Sleepless in America. Bedtiming. Sleeping through the night. The no-cry sleep solution. I don't know if I buy that.
Hi, Liz. This is Elizabeth Pantley, author of The No Cry Sleep Solution.
Pantley lives in Seattle, and we spoke over Skype. She has four kids and one grandson.
And I've helped all of them sleep better without ever having any of them cry it out.
Theories about how to get babies to sleep fall along a continuum from cry it out methods to more gentle and time-consuming techniques. Pantley firmly believes that letting babies cry until they fall asleep is unnecessary and ultimately unhelpful.
Just because they've stopped crying doesn't mean they've learned how to fall asleep in a peaceful way, or even to fall asleep on their own.
Pantley says there are lots of things parents can do. Create a proper sleep environment with a dark room and white noise. Notice when the child is yawning and zoning out and put them to bed. Create bed and nap time routines that help the baby know when it's time to sleep. But even with all of that, most babies aren't just going to roll over and go to sleep. They'll need to be rocked or nursed or otherwise coaxed into sleeping.
There's a reason why sleep deprivation is used for torture.
Francesca Tortorello's first child, Alexander, was born in November.
You feel like you finally get the baby to sleep, and you put the baby down and you close your eyes, and an hour can pass, but it feels like 2 minutes.
Tortorello and her husband, Michael De Bruin, are both professional musicians.
No, Alexander's turn? Okay. His new favorite thing is to sit on my lap and bang on the piano, which, you know, makes my heart melt a little bit.
But she says missing sleep night after night took a toll on her work.
It's hard to go to work and play your instrument well when you're exhausted.
On her relationship.
I mean, we were sniping at each other.
On her new role as a parent.
And I need the sleep to be the best mom I can be.
So when Alexander was 5 months old, Tortorello decided it was time to sleep train. She knew that when he woke at night crying, it wasn't because he was hungry. It was because he didn't know how to fall back asleep on his own. She chose a modified version of the cry it out method, where she went in and checked on Alexander every 5 minutes. The first night, he cried for 35 minutes. Tortorello says it was hard to listen to. But the next night, there was less crying.
And then, I don't know, 4 nights in or something, it was 5-10 minutes and he's asleep.
Finally, they had their evenings back. They're more rested and happier. And they say Alexander is happier too, because he's also getting more sleep. Pediatrician, sleep expert, and father of three, Todd Woolen, teaches a method similar to the one that Tortorello and De Bruin used.
I feel very comfortable in saying that sleep is a trainable, teachable thing.
He says the key is letting kids figure out how to fall asleep on their own, but with reassurance from parents that they're safe and cared for.
Once kids nail that, that's gold, because then they've set up a skill that they can use for the rest of their life.
Well, Lynn says people who were lousy sleepers as kids often end up being lousy sleepers as adults, which can have health implications.
Good restorative sleep has great benefits, whether it's in growth or embedding memories or in chronic disease.
Good sleep is good health, says Wu Lin, a point on which Pantley agrees.
So we want to make sure that our child is getting adequate sleep in order to be healthy and vibrant and grow and be strong and happy.
They both also say that getting enough sleep allows parents to be more engaged with their children during waking hours, boosting development, and that the long nights eventually turn into short years. And before you know it, you have a teenager who you can't get out of bed. I'm Liz Reed, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been nearly a year since what had originally been known as Almano was renamed Hazelwood Green, major redevelopment of riverfront acreage that used to be home to one of the most productive steel operations in the area. We're going to talk about how this proposal fits in with, does it fit in, with the neighborhood's own plans. Sonia Tillman is the executive director of the Hazelwood Initiative. Reverend Tim Smith is the pastor of Keystone Church of Hazelwood and executive director of the Center of Life. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
So the Hazelwood Initiative started as a neighborhood task force taking on small issues, maybe illegal dumping, abandoned cars, issues that might take away from the appearance, the image, maybe the quality of life. But Sonia, I'll start with you. You've taken on bigger community-wide challenges and opportunities, haven't you?
Sure. Our roots are in issue advocacy and community supporting events, and we still do that type of work, but we also have broadened into our economic development spaces has broadened a bit to include both affordable housing and business development. So we're working very diligently to ensure that any renter in Hazelwood who wants to be a homeowner can be, and that our business district is something that serves the community well.
Okay. So you have business district, homeowners, development, but let's bring in Tim here. They all impact people. So Tim, what is the role of Center of Life in the Hazelwood community?
Well, our role is to give the people and the residents of Hazelwood, the tools, the equipment, the education, the resources that are necessary for them to become strong, their families to become strong, so that they can make their own community strong. So the idea for us is that, you know, whatever happens with respect to development, that it's an inside job, mm-hmm. and that the architects or the blueprint of whatever happens are the people.
I want to get into the two plans. The Greater Hazelwood Plan, which is the initiative of the Hazelwood neighborhood, the people there, and then the Hazelwood Green, which is the development, as I said, along the riverfront. But both involve change. And I'd like you both to tackle this one. Is there an excitement about change? Is there some fear about change, Tim?
I think the people in Hazelwood are cautiously optimistic, and I think they have reason to be cautious. And I think people are looking at what is happening and as they measure that against what has happened in other communities, how development has typically happened in other communities, and what has happened to people who may have even been in their family members living in some of these communities and the things that they have experienced. And so, you know, the jury is not in yet on all of this. People are still looking at what's going to happen, because at the end of the day, it's not so much what you say, but it's actually what you do and how, you know, and how you bring that together.
I completely concur with Pastor Tim. I think one of the really great things that has come out of this Greater Hazelwood neighborhood planning process is that there was really nothing too surprising that came out of this broader engagement of the community. It really reaffirmed things that we already knew were priorities for the community, like affordable housing, like helping entrepreneurs, like small business development. Those are things that we, in our smaller discussions and our regular monthly meetings where much of the community can't attend regularly, were reaffirmed when we had broader community meetings where 100 people came. So it was very a very good process, I think. Still continuing.
I want to follow up on what something Pastor Tim said, that sort of cautious optimism. Wait and see because of what they've experienced, maybe friends, neighbors, elsewhere in other communities. In attending a few community meetings, I heard several times from residents, we don't want this, the Hazelwood Green Project, to turn into another homestead waterfront development. First of all, what do they mean by that? And is there still that concern? Has that been sort of eased at all?
No, I think there is still that concern. It comes from what we saw in Homestead. We saw another community being built with retail in it that had its back to the community itself, Homestead. And so And the residual effects of that is still happening. So people see that, and we look at the fact that we are a waterfront community, that there is the possibility that, you know, retail could happen down there. We have a train track that runs right in the middle of our community. So all of those dynamics are very similar. And so we remain cautious. We're optimistic because we haven't taken a wait and see approach so much. We have a wait and see approach from the standpoint of when we hear people say that this is what they're going to do, we're going to wait and see that. But we're not waiting for them to do what needs to be done in our community. We're working together as a community to make things better, you know, for every single resident. That's a part of what our plan is, you know, to make sure that every person living in the community who have lived in that community and those who are coming will be served and better served by whatever kind of development happens.
So I wanted to ask you, is there concern about separation? Project manager Rebecca Flora has used the term extension as in an extension of the community itself. Is that how it's being viewed in the Hazelwood community, that Hazelwood Green is an extension of the Hazelwood neighborhood and its own business? Or, again, wait and see? Or is there worry about
separation?
I think
extension is probably not the right word, because that space, that those 178 acres, are already part of Hazelwood. It's about reintegrating it back into what it was before the steel mill. And so it is encouraging that the preliminary land development plan, which goes before the Planning Commission tomorrow, 2 o'clock, it's a public meeting, shows streets reconnecting through the site. But as Pastor Sim said, we have 2 railroad tracks actually that go through the site. We're not going to get new streets that cross those railroad tracks. So we have to ensure that the connections that we can have that rebuild part of the grid, rebuild it into the community, are strong. We have to be vigilant about that.
Is there more than the physical connection? You know, the street, okay, streets
Absolutely.
Or no streets, but it's the, you know, the unification or of Hazelwood?
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be a difficult piece. But there are many public spaces that are built into Hazelwood Green's plan. We just need to work to make sure that they actually are public.
I think that the, you know, I like to give credit where credit is due as we wait.
Right.
And that I do think that Rebecca and Katrina, her daughter from Remake, have done they've been very intentional about keeping the lines of communication open with the anchor community anchor community groups within the community. I chair the Greater Hazelwood Community Collaborative, which is a collaboration of community-based and non-community-based service providers, and we exist to make sure that development or new development doesn't happen to us but through us. And so, and Rebecca and Katrina are very active on that group as well. I think the other part of this that make the community, at least community leadership, optimistic is that the support that we've had from the foundation community. I think that it's unusual for a foundation to be in a community and stay with the community for this many years. I could be wrong, but these are significant significant contributions and significant commitments over this many years.
Tanya.
I would say, speaking from a development perspective, if a private developer had purchased that 178 acres, they would not have been able to be as patient as the foundation community has been in waiting 15 years.
The foundation community owns that
the foundation
property.
Community owns that property in order for vertical development to begin, right? A private developer just didn't have that kind of luxury. They would have developed something that may not have been in the best interest of the larger community.
Okay. So is there... I want to talk about the Greater Hazelwood plan, your plan. But is there anything about the Hazelwood Green plan that you like or you're questioning right now, or is it still, again, wait and see?
Well, I think right off the bat, the community really responded very positively to the way the RIDC is doing the Mill 19 building.
Which is what?
Keeping the bones of the building and sort of the inside structure of the building. It still looks like a mill almost,
right.
but the way they're making it is so that you have sort of remnants and some memory of what it used to look like, which is a connection to the community because most of the people in the community at one time worked in that mill. So it's kind of honoring the past a little bit there. And I think working really hard to connect the streets to make natural connections from where everybody's kind of living right now, which is on the other side of the tracks, to the
Hazelwood.
To the Hazelwood Green site. You know, we sit on committees with respect to the land landscaping of that site as well. So there's been a lot of positive moves in that area. You know.
So let's get to the Greater Hazelwood plan. What is the essence? What is at the heart of this plan? Are you getting any support from the project managers of Hazelwood Green? So what's at the essence? What does the neighborhood want?
I think the neighborhood, in short, wants a community for them, right? They want to make sure that when this community develops, that they have the ability to stay, whether that's in the rental units that they currently exist in, or if they want to become homeowners, that they are allowed to stay in a community that they've lived in for years. So it's not that they don't welcome other people. I think we want additional people because we want the amenities that come with a broader community, but they don't want to get displaced by the new stuff that comes. They want to benefit from that as well.
Yeah. So you said allowed. Do you mean they're able to afford or something beyond that?
That they're able to afford to stay, that it is a place where they can thrive.
What is your sense in talking with people, the neighbors of Hazelwood every day, Pastor Tim, what they want?
Well, they want the same thing that we've been wanting for years. They want jobs. They want opportunity. They want, as Sonia said, they want to be able to stay in the houses that they live in. They want to see those houses get better, you know, be able to have resources so they can make their homes better. We want green space, of course. We want walking paths, bike paths. I mean, the community has been pretty consistent over the years of the things that they want. But also what we want in particular through this neighborhood plan is clear understanding of how we're going to do business with organizations, with whether they be educational institutions, whether they be light industry, corporation, medical. We want clear understanding of how we're going to do business with the city, with the county, with the state. We want to know how we're going to do business, and we want that to be clear on paper. We want them to work with us in a fair and just way. And I think that what we're seeing in the community now, where we're starting to see a lot more traffic now, we're starting to see a lot more police presence, we're seeing things that we've never seen before. And when we started Center of Life, it was hard to see a lot of police officers or a lot of resources and different things like that. And we're thinking, okay, we're starting to get all this attention now. Right. But we want that attention to be there for people who live in the community and not because of just all of the, you know, excitement around new buildings.
Right. Just a couple of minutes left. So is there any linkage between, I'll call it the community plan, the greater Hazelwood plan, the community plan, and Hazelwood Green? Is there any linkage? I know Rebecca Flores sits on a steering committee, but does the community plan, the greater Hazelwood plan, need anything from Hazelwood Green? And can you move even faster than they are moving? We'll start with you, Sonia.
I think what's in the preliminary land development plan for Hazelwood Green that's going before commission tomorrow has been informed by the public meetings that we've had around our community plan. So they understand that we want strong connections to the site, that it has to be part of the community. They understand that if they are able to have access to the river, right, if that site is, then the community as a whole needs to have access to the river, that there's nothing down there that is exclusive to Hazelwood Green because it is part of Hazelwood. And I think that they've listened to us. So we not only do we expect the preliminary land development plan to continue to reflect those things, but they continue to work with us on things like affordable housing for a broad community plan. Rebecca will sit on a committee that is community-based that will talk about the housing strategy for the community as a whole, and that's something that will be supported by what's in our neighborhood plan and what's in the preliminary land development plan.
Pastor Tim.
Well, I think I would just say this because I think this would be the elephant in the room almost, that we don't want to have to deal with what do they call non-disclosure agreements, mm-hmm. where people have conversations about our community and the people in our community without talking to us. And I think that Rebecca and Katrina have been pretty intentional about talking with us and making sure that we're at the table. And now that hasn't been the case in other situations, and it hasn't always been the case with the city or the county. And so, you know, we want to make sure that does not happen as we move forward, you know, with the rest of the development.
Okay. Closing 30 seconds go to you, Sonia, and that is this. We've heard talking with, listening to, but are you confident they'll maybe infuse what you're saying into their actions when it comes to Hazelwood Green?
I'm confident that we have a partner that listens to us, but I think that Tim was right in the beginning when he said that we are cautiously optimistic. This is something that we have to remain vigilant about.
All right. Final thoughts, Tim?
Final thoughts is that everybody that wants to be a part of what's going on in Hazelwood, register for the University of Hazelwood because it's a university.
All right. That's Pastor Tim Smith of the Keystone Church of Hazelwood and Executive Director of the Center of Life. Sonia Tillman is the Executive Director of the Hazelwood Initiative. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, we'll speak with Scott Brady, the U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania, about his marching orders from Washington and his approach to undocumented immigrants. Plus, tens of millions are being spent in Pennsylvania for races for Senate, the House, the governor's office. What's the source of the money and the implications? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.